American Free Press Audio Edit in 3 and 4, January 14 and 21, 2019. Feds go after Bundys again. Rancher updates AFP readers on persecution of family. By Mark Anderson. The federal government is intent on appealing the dismissal of charges against Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, two of his sons, and another supporter stemming from their now legendary protest against Bureau of Land Management, BLM, policies, as reported in AFP's front page story in the August 27 and September 3, 2018 issue. During the holidays, AFP caught up with family patriarch Cliven Bundy to get his take on the situation at this one-year anniversary of the January 8, 2018 ruling and the five-year anniversary of the April 2014 protest. The Bundys had faced various charges of conspiracy, obstruction, threats, and assault for the protest, which involved peacefully squaring off with federal agents and contractors who showed up to seize the family's cattle under court order. The high-profile case was dismissed by U.S. District Judge Gloria M. Navarro. However, after a long, grueling trial, during which Bundy and the other defendants languished in jail amid sometimes harsh treatment, she scolded the government for its conduct in the case, finding that federal prosecutors had concealed evidence favorable to the defense. The judge dismissed the case with prejudice, meaning the government should not be allowed to retry the defendants regarding the protest. My attorney, Larry Klayman of Judicial Watch, just wrote a letter to the Justice Department trying to get them to drop that appeal. He told AFP, they haven't dropped it yet and they indicated they were going forward with it. You know, it's Judge Navarro. I feel like she's the one who needs to defend her decision there, but the attorneys don't look at it that way, and they think they've got to get in there and have a big battle. Bundy agreed that this would violate double jeopardy, but the government doesn't seem to care. They were questioning Judge Navarro's decision in sending her decision to the Ninth Circuit for appeal. I don't see how they can do that, but the government just seems like they're after me. They don't care what they do. They were going to get me one way or the other, I guess. Klayman, who founded Judicial Watch and another government watchdog group, Freedom Watch, was quoted December 21, 2018 in a WND News exclusive as saying, in light of the history of this case and the gross injustice which has already been meted out against my client Cliven Bundy, his sons, and family by rogue Obama era prosecutors, the only reason for an appeal would be to cover up for corrupt prosecutors. He added that the behavior of prosecutors in the case remains under review by the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility and the Inspector General. Unfortunately, Bundy does not seem convinced that President Donald Trump will step in to shut down the lawsuit. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions was supposed to have an investigation of this whole thing and supposedly got this rolling forward, but we never heard any more about that, he said. Either Sessions didn't do what he said he was going to do, or he dropped the ball. People are always asking the question, who's pushing the button here? You know, back in the Obama administration, maybe one of those people was, but why is Trump's administration doing the same thing? APERSONALMESSAGEFROMTHEEDITOR. Don't let neocons sabotage peace, Mr. President. Whatever we may think of Dwight D. Eisenhower, we were recently reminded of his famous talk in August 1959 in London, where he remarked, I think that people want peace so much that one of these days governments had better get out of the way and let them have it. After decades of fighting wars on multiple fronts, the American people have clearly had it with war, so much so that 2 years ago they elected a president who, on the campaign trail, excoriated the power elite for their stupid wars and promised to bring our troops home from every far, off country that previous presidents had ordered them to place. And so it was that President Donald Trump made two bold moves recently, both of which will define his presidency, assuming he doesn't furiously backpedal under pressure from the warmongers, the chicken hawks, and the military profiteers who inhabit the swamp that is our nation's capital. This week we continue to celebrate the president's announcement that U.S. troops, who are currently illegally occupying the northwestern part of Syria, will be packing up their gear and returning soon to the U.S. And if that's not great news, we are also reporting that, finally, after 17 long years, The United States is trying to negotiate peace with the previous rulers of Afghanistan, the Taliban, who according to recent reports now control half of that country. Keep in mind that it is impossible to calculate the exact amount of money U.S. taxpayers have spent on the wars in Afghanistan and Syria. If you believe the Pentagon, U.S. taxpayers have spent around $45 billion a year in Afghanistan alone, or nearly $1 trillion since the U.S. first invaded the country a month after the September 11, 2001 attacks. In truth, it's probably significantly higher than that figure, since under President Barack Obama the number of U.S. troops ballooned to around 100,000, not including the tens of thousands of private mercenaries who have been hired by the Pentagon. Today, the U.S. has around 16,000 troops left in the mountainous country. As for Syria, it's even harder to get an accurate figure of just how much U.S. taxpayers have had to fork over to not just keep U.S. forces in Syria but to fund and arm the radical groups that have been trying to overthrow the government there. According to estimates by anti-war groups, the best guess is that the U.S. has ponied up around $100 billion for Syria, which includes the dozens of cruise missiles they fired at it. All told, a report by the Defense Department released in late 2018 indicates that, since the September 11 attacks, the collective wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria have cost more than $1.5 trillion, a huge sum of money to waste even when you consider that it doesn't include any black operations carried out by the CIA or payments to private mercenary firms. We'd be remiss if we didn't bring up a problem with all of this, though. No sooner had Trump made his announcement last December that he was declaring victory in Syria and scaling back operations in Afghanistan, than the deep state ran behind his back to tell the press, "No, in point of fact, the president is not doing any of that." On a trip to Israel of all places, Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, who has never seen a war he didn't like, publicly contradicted the president, saying U.S. troops would be staying in Syria until all of the radical Islamists in the region were defeated and Turkey guaranteed they were not going to attack the Kurds. For what it's worth, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did echo Trump's original call for bringing home U.S. troops, saying the president's withdrawal plan does not change the mission of destroying the Islamic State terror group. So the question remains, who will be setting policy for the United States? John Bolton or Donald Trump? In this week's issue, St. Patrick, Phil Giraldi, and Dr. Ron Paul all tackle this issue with the kind of objectivity you could only expect from American Free Press. Read their contributions carefully and then take a moment to write down your own thoughts in a letter and send it to us. Tell us what you think. Is Trump right to bring our troops home, or do we owe it to our allies to remain in the Middle East, even if it means we will bankrupt the nation? We will publish your thoughtful letters in upcoming issues. H. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor. Rashiagat Collusion Theory Collapses. Former mainstream journalist begins questioning InfoMasteel dossier. By St. Patrick. Radio host John Ziegler was not supposed to stymie veteran journalist and author Michael Isakoff. Ziegler was a friendly interviewer for Isakoff, the co-author of Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. But Isakoff, one of the earliest Washington, D.C. journalists to go all-in on Rashiagat, is now in a precarious situation, certain that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller would find clear evidence that the 2016 Donald Trump campaign had colluded with Russian agents to use hacked DNC emails to influence voters. Isakoff had also eagerly accepted the now-to-be-a-steal dossier as fact. 2 years later, the initial Rashiagat thesis is dwindling and its major proponents have been left twisting in the wind. In the guest introduction, Ziegler calls Isakoff one of the few journalists he actually respects and declares himself a big fan. Listeners then know that this is going to be a game of slow-pitch softball with Isakoff batting clean up. So when asked to compare Trump's situation with that of pre-impeachment Bill Clinton, Isakoff carefully now sidesteps the direct accusations made in his 339-page book. 10 months after its publication, Isakoff now says, "Look, with Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say we don't have the full, complete evidence of what prosecutors have accumulated. We don't know exactly what, Michael Cohen's testimony is about his conversations with then-candidate Trump. We still need to know exactly what the evidence is on this case. In comparing Clinton to Trump throughout the interview, Isakoff pointed out that it was the story of sexual compromise in a Russian hotel room that really had kicked off the Russiagate theories. But it is that story, the tale of Trump and Russian hookers, that Isakoff surprisingly and openly calls the sensational, uncorroborated allegation in the Steele dossier that kicked off the Russia story into that her orbit. Isakoff's mention of the Steele dossier prompted a follow-up from the host, who said, in the question, that the dossier had been unfairly derided, especially by Trump fans, having just set up his guest to hit from the tee. Ziegler asks, would you agree that a lot of what is in the Steele dossier has been at least somewhat vindicated? The use of qualifying terms in the question allowed Isakoff an enormous amount of room to say, yes, no, Isakoff answered, you would not? Ziegler asks, sounding completely stunned, no, Isakoff repeats. When Ziegler asked why Isakoff now questions the document upon which much of his book's thesis was based, Isakoff attempted to dance around the outer edges of the issue without flatly denying the dossier, and thus his own work. I think, in broad strokes, Christopher Steele was clearly onto something, that there was a major Kremlin effort to interfere in our elections, Isakoff said cautiously with a wide array of careful pauses, that they were trying to help Trump's campaign, and that there were multiple contacts between various Russian figures close to the government and various figures in Trump's campaign. That much has been established by the public record. Then came the surprise clarification that Trump supporters never saw coming from the veteran of the Washington Post, Newsweek, and NBC News. When you actually get into the details of the Steele dossier, the specific allegations, we have not seen the evidence to support them, Isakoff said. In fact, there is good grounds to think that some of the more sensational allegations will never be proven and are likely false. So I think it's a mixed record at this point. Based on the public record at this point, I have to say that most of the specific allegations have not been borne out. Near the end of the interview, Ziegler finally asked Isakoff the biggest question at hand, is the case for Russian collusion imploding? Isakoff stumbled over some words and answered in an attempt to save his own credibility, I think the case we made in Russian roulette, that the Russian government launched an unprecedented effort to interfere in our democratic process, is rock solid, Isakoff said. I think that case has been more than supported by Robert Mueller's investigation. That's real. Whether that translates into the magic word collusion or criminal charges to others in the Trump campaign, we are not there. And I think the evidence is growing that we are likely not going to be there. All the signs to me are that Mueller is reaching his endgame and that we may see less than what many people want him to find. Isakoff is surprisingly honest in the interview. He is one of the many journalists who are now having to recognize the harsh reality of their withering political dreams if they want to continue with this story. Mueller, himself, who was recently granted another 6 months to make his case, has had to widen the scope of the investigation because the original Russiagate collusion story is faulty, or non-existent. While there have been unethical misdoings by some officials that have surrounded Trump, the Russiagate story is, from all appearances, a stockpile of fake news. What really killed rising journalist, Christian conservative writer Bray Peyton dies, allegedly from freakish case of swine flu, by Donald Jeffries on December 28, 2018. Bray Peyton, 26-year-old staff writer for the conservative website The Federalist, died suddenly. Peyton's friend, San Diego politician Morgan Murtaugh, found her unresponsive early in the morning of the 27th. She was rushed to a hospital, and a web page that was very quickly set up informed the public, after a CT scan and hours of testing, they have determined she has the H1N1 flu and possibly meningitis. She was placed in a medically induced coma and deteriorated rapidly. Murtaugh announced her death in a tweet on Friday. Thank you everyone for your prayers. It is with a heavy heart that I type this. Unfortunately, Bray has passed. Please send prayers to her family. Rest in paradise, you beautiful soul. The Washington, D.C., based Peyton was in California to guest host a show on the One America News Network. Jack Posobiec, a regular host on the network, expressed the startling abruptness of her death. Everyone says she seemed perfectly fine on Wednesday when she hosted. Bray was a young star who always shared her Christian faith. All of us are in shock and tears, and we are praying for her family. Peyton had a bright future ahead of her and had already made numerous appearances on television networks like Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN. Peyton was also known to be an anti-vaxxer, one of an increasing number of Americans aware of the strong indications that vaccinations are linked to a variety of afflictions, including autism. In 2011, Peyton had tweeted, "State urges more people to get vaccinated. No, vaccines are from the devil." Although information from official sources was scarce, many online claimed that the particular strain that allegedly killed Peyton affected no one else in the state of California. H1N1 is more commonly referred to as the swine flu. Peyton was said to be reporting on the migrant caravan at the time of her death, and barely 2 weeks previously had broken a hard-hitting story about Robert Mueller's team deleting text messages before they could be reviewed. Peyton's deadly illness came on in an astonishingly swift manner. Her last tweets, at 9:36 p.m. Wednesday night, consisted of a promo for viewers to tune in and watch her guest host the OWN program Tipping Point and a final reply of appreciate it, to a compliment at 10:06 p.m. One doesn't have to be a so-called conspiracy theorist to question how a healthy and vibrant 26-year-old could be discovered nearly dead from some sort of flu meningitis combination less than 10 hours later. Everyone reported she'd seemed perfectly normal the previous night. It is difficult to believe that whatever illness took her life could come on so abruptly, without any warning signs. While the initial reports mentioned meningitis, The New York Times noted in its obituary that Miss Peyton had the H1N1 flu, also known as the swine flu, and encephalitis. According to her family, meningitis and encephalitis are two different ailments. How could her family have confused them? In a January 3 Inside Edition story headlined, "How Did Swine Flu Kill a Rising Political Star in Just Hours?" Mystery Haunts Family, it was revealed that her family stated, "She went to bed with flu-like symptoms and never woke up." Her father, George, declared, "When I dropped her off at the train, she seemed fine." Her mother reported speaking to her Wednesday night, when she told her she was nauseous and unable to keep anything down. "The doctor doesn't actually know what caused all of it," Peyton's father said, "and we may never know." As many have noted on internet forums, swine flu symptoms typically are present for quite some time before it becomes a deadly threat. Peyton had exhibited rare courage for a journalist, especially one of such tender years. She had exposed how her local municipality installed $2 million of special artistic lighting under a highway where a bunch of homeless people lived, forcing them to relocate. She once witnessed a junkie overdose in public and had to prod police, who were ignoring the situation, into taking life-saving measures. Many in the alternative media compared her death to those of journalist Michael Hastings, who strangely ran his car into a tree at a very high speed after announcing he was going off the grid to break a huge story, and the founder of Breitbart News, Andrew Breitbart, who dropped dead at a young age immediately upon declaring he was going to blow the lid off of Barack Obama's real history. Short life expectancies are common among those who challenge the deep state. Globalists unite against populism. By Mark Anderson, the head of one of the world's oldest elite foreign policy institutions in London, is calling for the world's pro-globalist think tanks to unite like never before, lest their neoliberal world order dissolve in the rising populist tide. Chatham House director Dr. Robin Niblett, in an 11,000-word article entitled "Rediscovering a Sense of Purpose: The Challenge for Western Think Tanks," declared, "To devise a common work, program, do think tanks from across the world also need to possess a common sense of purpose? After something like 100 years of think tank experience, the answer is yes." Chatham House, also known as the Royal Institute of International Affairs, is a member of the original array of gilded private institutes that arose and revolutionized the world of geopolitics in the early 20th century. Other major members include the Carnegie Endowment for International Affairs, shown to have been involved in apparently treasonous activities by the Rees Committee in the 1950s, along with the Brookings Institution, an Of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, echoing the grave concerns expressed during 2018 by CFR President Richard Haass to Britain's House of Lords, Nibla noted in his article that he's apprehensive about the rise of populist politics, the implication being that think tanks must either modify their mission or risk becoming increasingly irrelevant, possibly to the point of losing their grip on influencing government policy largely from behind the throne, something they've perfected ever since the eldest think tank's early bet on successful efforts to push the U.S. into the League of Nations, a failed forerunner of the United Nations. The deeper challenge for Western think tanks is whether they can rediscover a sense of purpose as fit for the 21st century as that which mobilized their counterparts in the early 20th century, Niblatt wrote with noticeable nostalgia regarding the early days of stealthy power brokering. He added that the world's think tanks need to stand for certain core principles of governance that have been shown by the experience of the last 100 years to offer the best prospects for sustainable security and prosperity. Exactly whose sustainable security and prosperity is at stake is never made clear, though the pinnacled investment class that undergirds these think tanks, and assuredly not the average citizen, is a safe bet. However, Niblatt confesses that the age of the Internet, whatever its shortcomings, has generally enabled the citizenry to become better informed and therefore more skeptical of elite opinion. Niblatt put it as gingerly as he could. Policy audiences appear less interested in the outputs of think tanks if they believe that these have no public resonance beyond the expert circles in which they were developed. Therefore, he added, think tanks have to apply a growing proportion of their resources to trying to mobilize popular engagement with their ideas. One approach has been to raise their public profile by commenting more on current policy developments, rather than analyzing their underlying drivers. The danger is that this blurs the line between think tanks and the media. What he's not saying, however, is that these tax-exempt outfits have long collaborated with the news media, even to the point of media personnel speaking at, or moderating, programs produced by these institutions but never reporting objectively on them. In this manner, the think tanks, lavishly funded by uber-wealthy donors, banks, war profiteers, and other well-connected entities, help formulate public policy with almost nothing in the way of general publicity on how their power, centralizing ideas are massaged and implemented as public policy. Niblatt evidently felt compelled to further confess that think tanks, as critics have long contended, really are a bridge between the super-rich and government and supply personnel to government itself, beyond formulating policy. In the United States, think tanks became holding pens for future appointees to presidential administrations, where they developed and honed their ideas for future policy, he revealingly wrote, adding that a 1974 Brookings Institution study resulted in the creation of the Congressional Budget Office, and the Center for Strategic and International Studies in 1986 helped reform the command of the U.S. military. Such modesty, authors such as James Perloff have shown, via his highly respected book The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline, that these think tanks played a nefarious role in defaming and subduing American isolationism and manipulating government policy to assure U.S. entry into World War II and, from there, laid the groundwork for America to police the world, an essential component of building world government. And while Niblatt admits that the world's think tanks have at times blundered in their pursuit of globalization, and that their worldview has its inherent weaknesses, he remains confident that these think tanks, if they combine forces and arrive at a set of lasting principles with which they can reinvent themselves, can continue to short-circuit national sovereignty and real democratic impulses, which they deride as populism, and instead promote a false democracy as a cover for rule by an unelected oligarchy, the very antithesis of democratic government. Neocon calls for sinking the stock market to oust Trump. By St. Patrick, how does a neoconservative celebrate Christmas? In the case of John Podhoretz, you spread the season's greetings by decrying a 1,000-point increase in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. If this isn't your version of being either holly or jolly, then you further explain that your disappointment was brought on by the idea that a better economy may slow a potential impeachment of President Donald Trump. This is exactly what Podhoretz did on Twitter the day after Christmas. Podhoretz wrote online, "How many people's hearts sank when they saw the Dow went up 1,000 points because they really hoped Trump had plunged us into a bear market that would cause GOP legislators to turn on him and support removal after impeachment." A day later, aghast that anyone had an issue with his original statement, Podhoretz responded, "Some lunatics are claiming this tweet represents a celebration of the market drop. I'm actually getting hate mail about it. Everyone is insane." Podhoretz was not the only one to actively hope for a faltering economy. Comedian and host Bill Maher did so in June. "I feel like the bottom has to fall out at some point," Maher said. "By the way, I'm hoping for it because one way you get rid of Trump is a crashing economy. So please, bring on the recession. Sorry if that hurts people, but it's either root for a recession or you lose your democracy." After receiving substantial criticism for his remarks, Maher, whose net worth is $100 million, clarified his statements. "A recession is a survivable event. What Trump is doing to this country is not." Maher can be excused for his remarks. He is a career stand-up comic whose show thrives on his ability to say controversial things that will attract eyes and ears to the show. It is what he does, and it is how his show survives. In the case of the Podhoretz tweets, there is a marked difference. Podhoretz is a former speechwriter for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. He is the editor of the conservative commentary magazine and a columnist for the New York Post. He has also written a few books on politics, including Bush Country, How to Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. His political and literary careers have dealt primarily with words. He knows what they mean, he knows their effect, and there is no reason to believe that he didn't know exactly what he was doing when he wrote the original tweet. More than a singular statement from an inconsequential commentator, Podhoretz is emblematic of a neoconservative cabal that detests the populist wing of the Republican Party. This is a wing that may even be willing to leave the party for a libertarian candidate if a viable candidacy were to ever emerge. While every pen, keyboard, and microphone of the neoconservative faction is now pointed directly at the Trump presidency, this did not begin in 2016. They detested Pat Buchanan's populist run in 1992 and have spent much of the past decade and a half foiling the youth and online-based uprising of Ron Paul supporters. As neoconservatives like Podhoretz see their profitable war state crumbling in Syria and Afghanistan, they now set their sights on Pennsylvania Avenue. This is the new battlefield. Podhoretz, like many Generation X neoconservatives, hides behind his own faux hipness as a movie and television critic. Comedian Dennis Miller called the verbose Podhoretz his favorite movie critic, but this is what they do, the new era of neocons. Their parents were so steeped in the monumental issues of their day that friendships would end over political ideologies. Their children cloak their ideology with Mary Tyler Moore Show references to Chuckles Bites the Dust. But in a world increasingly more transparent, the true believers are eventually outed, not by the congressional committees of their parents and not by a senator, Joe McCarthy. They out themselves at some point. The health of the Dow is meaningless to most Americans. It's a gamble to a great degree and measures little more than the confidence of the investor class. It does not determine that a mid-level manager will treat a minimum wage employee with more humanity and respect. It does not fix the perpetual war state or the prison industrial complex that exists today. It does not repair a flatlining public education system, and it does not determine what you will pay at the gas pump. To many city conservatives like Podhoretz, a New York City fixture, the stock market is the lifeblood of fiscal and political health. As Americans struggle to pay rising energy bills, the neocons openly support the coup. If only there were a permanent wall between these two camps. Neocons sabotaging Syria withdrawal plan. Former U.S. Rep. wonders if president has any control over foreign policy. By Dr. Ron Paul. I am starting to wonder whether President Donald Trump has any power over U.S. foreign policy at all. Many people believe that the president is just a figurehead, with actual foreign policy firmly in the hands of the deep state. When Trump announced just a couple of weeks ago that the U.S. was removing its troops from Syria and possibly reducing troops from Afghanistan, the neocons, the media, the military-industrial complex, and the left wing never. Trump people were livid. They were silent when President Barack Obama made the horrible decision to overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria and send weapons to jihadists to do so. They never said a word when billions of dollars were committed to this immoral and dangerous regime change policy. They weren't interested in the rule of law when Obama thumbed his nose at Congress and sent troops into Syria. But when Trump declared the obvious, that ISIS was effectively defeated and that we had no business being in Syria, these above groups in unison declared that actually bringing U.S. troops home was a gift to Russia. They said bringing U.S. troops home would create instability in the regions they left. Well, is there any proof that occupation by U.S. troops actually brings stability? No sooner did Trump announce our departure than his neocon advisors began walking his words back. First he had to endure a lunch with Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, reading him the Riot Act, where, according to the senator, Trump agreed to no timetables for departure. Then National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo began to tell the world that Trump's statements on troop pullout were just empty words, not U.S. policy. While Syrian Christians newly liberated from the rule of U.S. backed extremists celebrated Christmas for the first time in years, Bolton dusted off the old warning to Assad that the U.S. would attack if he again gassed his people, with the Syrian presidents personally taking part in some of the Christmas celebrations. Does anybody really believe he'd go back to his office and order a gas attack? Bolton then claimed that the U.S. would shift troops from Syria to Iraq to continue fighting ISIS and that the U.S. fully backs Israeli airstrikes on Syrian territory. Did Trump even agree to any of this? Even worse, Pompeo is embarking on a Middle East tour where he will essentially tell leaders in the region that the U.S. president is a liar. According to one State Department official, Pompeo's message to the Middle East will be, despite reports to the contrary and false narratives surrounding the Syria decision, we are not going anywhere. The secretary will reinforce that commitment to the region and our partners, calling the president's actual words on Syria false narratives. How is this not insubordination? Will Trump stand by and watch this coup taking place under his nose? Does he realize how his credibility suffers when he boldly announces a U.S. withdrawal and then does a U-turn days later? Has he noticed recent polls showing that the majority of the American people agree with him? Why is he so intimidated by the neocons? U.S. locked into endless cycle of war, by Philip Giraldi in the 18th century. The Vicomte de Mirabeau famously quipped, "Other states possess an army. Prussia is an army which possesses a state. There is considerable danger that the United States is proceeding down the same road." As military spending has become untouchable and America continues to play the role of world policeman, some recent commentary has been suggesting that the United States is becoming a second-rate military power because it is not spending enough money on weapons. Given the fact that Washington spends more on its military than the next 10 countries combined, the premise would seem to be either completely ridiculous or evidence of waste, fraud, and mismanagement at the Department of Defense. Dodd, that far exceeds anything ever seen before. If it is true that the unaudited Pentagon has somehow mislaid $21 trillion over the course of 10 years, then no amount of increased spending will remedy the deficiencies in the Dodd procurement system. One might object that the Pentagon is not underfunded, pointing out that it is the U.S. military's perception of its mission that is grotesque, that no country needs 1,100 foreign bases worldwide to be secure. Nor does national defense require American soldiers to be fighting on multiple fronts in wars thousands of miles away that are undeclared, illegal under international law, and non-compliant with the Constitution of the United States of America. There is definitely something wrong with the way the establishment prioritizes spending by the government, which relates to how the allegedly underfunded military story is being presented. One might well argue that the national debt, which is currently nearly $22 trillion and has grown enormously in support of America's wars, is a far greater threat to the survival of the United States than is Iran or even Russia. That would be the fault of a feckless Congress and White House, which clearly don't believe in the old maxim that you can spend only what you earn. But instead of blaming the politicians, which is where the problem really derives from, the chattering class and media have instead focused on entitlements, The war on entitlements began, in its current formulation, with former Rep. Paul Ryan, RWSC, and it culminated in last year's Enrich the Rich tax cut. Working Americans will now be taxed on their taxes since they can no longer deduct state and local taxes from their incomes when paying their federal taxes. Ryan meanwhile has departed Congress with a handsome pension and generous health insurance for life and will embark on a new career as a seven-figure lobbyist. Much of the war on entitlements comes from neoconservative talking heads who mostly work for think tanks that are generously funded by defense contractors and pro-Israel oligarchs. The neocons are, like Ryan, well paid and benefited, much more so than the average American, so they have no real horse in the race apart from keeping the money flowing. An article that appeared recently in the Washington Post perfectly illustrates how the establishment and its media accomplices are selling a product that fearmongers use to sustain more military spending. It is entitled Wake Up, America's Military Isn't Invincible, written by regular columnist Robert J. Samuelson. The piece begins with, "The most uncovered story in Washington these days is the loss of U.S. military power, a lesson particularly important in light of recent events, the resignation of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, President Trump's rash decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, North Korea's announcement that it will keep nuclear weapons after all, and alleged massive computer hacking by Chinese nationals, but loss of U.S. military power, if it can be quantified at all, has nothing to do with Mattis or Syria, nor with North Korea or China, or even with Trump, who has increased the armed services budget." Samuelson makes his case by citing defense modernization programs in China and Russia and advances in Iran and North Korea that undercut U.S. military capabilities, but, if he were to be honest, he would be conceding that he is only discussing comparative advantage in some areas. He refers to a recent report suggesting that, because Russia and China have upgraded their capabilities, if the United States had to fight Russia in a Baltic contingency or China in a war over Taiwan, Americans could face a decisive military defeat. It should come as no surprise that the possible armed conflicts cited by Samuelson are carefully chosen to produce the desired result. Confronting Russia or China in their home waters thousands of miles away from the U.S. gives all the advantage to the defense, which will be able to operate on interior lines and maximize available land, sea, and air forces while the Americans have to rely on a lengthy and vulnerable logistical chain. The reality is that the U.S. is second to none in terms of ability to project power, with the United States uniquely having 19 aircraft carrier battle groups that can deliver significant military air power to anywhere in the world. Samuelson goes on to condemn what he calls unwise cuts in defense spending and blames the lack of money for the Pentagon on the American welfare state, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and the like. He advocates cutting welfare to buy more and better weapons. Since he is a neocon, it is obligatory that he include some reference to Adolf Hitler. In this case, he warns that Hitler's Germany rearmed while the rest of the world did nothing, an analogy that is not even true, as Germany was outnumbered and outgunned by its enemies when World War II started. As Samuelson is writing for the Washington Post, it is also necessary that he conclude with a slap of Trump. "We need to keep our commitments. Trump's abrupt withdrawal from Syria devalues our word, and we need to repair our alliances, but one might well opine that there is something seriously wrong with the kind of thinking, where weapons and the promotion of violence overseas always take precedence over meeting the needs of the American people. Government pension and health programs, largely paid for by contributions from workers, do a great deal of good for many Americans and would be even better managed if the Congress would stop raiding the various trust funds. Government exists to benefit the citizens that together make up the state, not to meddle in the affairs of other nations and peoples worldwide. The selling of America the vulnerable is a fiction promoted by those who make money from the continuation of a warfare nation. The United States and the American people have not benefited one bit from the pointless wars in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Real security will come when Washington brings the troops home." DAV, Desecrating American Veterans. World's largest veterans charity condones desecration of Black Cemetery. by Dave Gallery. The Disabled American Veterans, DAV, the veteran charity exclusively covered by American Free Press for the exorbitant incomes of its officers, is back in the news again, this time for desecrating an all-black cemetery in St. Louis, Mo. The story was brought to the attention of this newspaper by Wanda Brandon, who began a campaign to honor the dead in their final resting place, in the hopes of bringing this matter to the national stage. "I launched a campaign about the cemetery, which is Washington Park Cemetery, Miss," Brandon told this reporter. "It's located in St. Louis County in the city of Berkeley, which is a suburb right outside of St. Louis. Founded in 1920, the cemetery has a sordid past of abuse, and the latest insult to those interred there may be just what's needed to draw attention to this matter. I have several family members that are buried in the cemetery," she said, "and I have some that have been disinterred from the cemetery. There's a long history with this cemetery of neglect and abuse and desecration. In the late 1950s, the interstate highway system took land from the cemetery to run Interstate 70, and split the cemetery in half, with the land on the northern side of I-70 adjacent to St. Louis-Lambert International Airport, Missouri's biggest and busiest airport. In 1986, then-owner Virginia L. Younger leased some of the cemetery's land to DDI Media, a St. Louis-based billboard company with over 1,000 billboards across the country. The sale brought some much-needed attention on the cemetery, under scrutiny by county and state investigators, and dogged by civil lawsuits by those whose loved ones' graves could not be located. Missouri's Attorney General opened up their own investigation in January 1991. That same month, Miss Younger put a gun to her chest, writing on one of her four suicide notes that she was tired of being persecuted. Virginia Younger allowed billboards and cell phone towers to come into the cemetery before she killed herself, explained Miss Brandon. To add insult to injury to the cemetery, in the early 1990s, the city of St. Louis brought light rail transportation in and used eminent domain to further encroach on the land. After that, she explained, they disinterred well over 10,000 people from their final resting places to run the trains to the airport. Early in 2017, Miss Brandon had had enough and founded the Washington Park Cemetery Anti-Desecration League, armed with an official organization standing behind her. She set about on her mission. In July of that year, however, she was told by DDI Media that the company was not going to remove its billboards from the cemetery. "So that's when I decided to launch a campaign against the billboard company," she said. Her organization made a video, and in January 2018, the local press took notice and wrote their first story in May of that year. When even that didn't stop DDI, Wanda moved on to Plan B. On October 30, 2018, myself and other members of my organization began to contact the companies on the billboard to notify them where the billboard was located, she explained. And every last company had no clue that their billboard was inside of the cemetery sitting on top of graves. They all agreed to pull out their stakes except for the DAV and one other company. Ironically, there is a veteran buried right under the billboard DAV is advertising on. Miss Brandon reached out to that veteran's family, who contacted the DAV with no luck. "I contacted the DAV's headquarters in Kentucky, and I received an email eventually back from them, saying, in short, that they felt it was an honor to have their billboard inside of the cemetery." Undeterred, Miss Brandon reached out to the DAV in Washington, specifically the group's top dog, J. Mark Burgess, who earned $550,524 as the head of a veterans charity in 2017. "He was supposed to get in contact with me," she explained. "I never heard from him. I got a call back from his administrative assistant, and she asked for my address, and said that they wanted to send me a letter." She received a certified letter on Christmas Eve from the DAV commander, singing the same tune as the email she received, that the cemetery should be honored, that the DAV is dancing on the gravestones. "When our guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns." By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. "I have often wondered what is the real agenda of gun ban advocates. More people die from falls than from being shot. Deaths from accidents far exceed deaths from being shot. The FBI reports that there were 1,247,321 violent crimes in the U.S. in 2017. Aggravated assault and robbery account for 91% of violent crimes, rapes account for 7.7%, murders accounted for only 1.4% of violent crime. According to the FBI, there were 17,284 murders in 2017. Assailants using rifles killed 403 people, and 1,591 were killed by people using knives. Handguns were used in 7,032 killings, many of which resulted from criminals killing one another over, for example, drug distribution. The police were responsible for 987 shooting deaths, about one-fourth of which were mentally disturbed people. There were 40,327 motor vehicle accident deaths in 2017. About 4,000 people died from drowning. There were 34,673 deaths from accidental falls. There were 58,335 accidental poisoning deaths. All unintentional deaths totaled 161,374. It turns out that prescription drugs are the fourth leading cause of death, which puts it up there with cancer and heart attacks. Harvard University reports that properly prescribed medications hospitalize 1.9 million Americans annually, killing 128,000 people, which places prescribed medicines in fourth place, with strokes as a leading cause of death. Far more lives could be saved by focusing on careful drug testing rather than on gun control. What then explains the fixation and constant propaganda about banning assault rifles when the total annual murders by assailants using all kinds of rifles is 403? What explains the fixation on handguns that are the weapon of choice in only 41% of murders, numbering only 7,032 deaths? What is the point of disarming the population when private ownership of firearms prevents a large number of crimes? A study by criminologists Gary Kleck and Mark Gertz concluded that Americans use their guns annually to prevent more than 2 million crimes. John Lott also found that gun ownership reduces crime. Those who advocate banning gun ownership demur, claiming guns are used defensively 100,000 times a year. Why then do gun controllers want to take away guns that prevent crime six times the number of homicides? Those who want to ban guns use deceptive and dishonest terms such as gun violence, an illiterate use of language. Guns are inanimate objects like a hammer or a screwdriver. They are not capable of taking actions such as committing violence. They have to be used or misused by people intent on committing violence. Therefore, there can be no such thing as gun violence. There can only be violence committed by people using guns or hammers or screwdrivers, or whatever. Murders committed by assailants using handguns comprise a tiny 0.0056% of violent crimes. What explains the fixation on such a small problem? Moreover, gun ban advocates, who so deplore the deaths by gun violence of Americans they have never met, are short on sympathy for the millions of victims of American gun violence in the Middle East and North Africa. They show no concern about the mounting conflicts orchestrated by Washington with Russia and China, conflicts that could destroy all life on Earth in nuclear Armageddon. Clearly, gun ban advocates are insincere about the few deaths of strangers that they so greatly deplore and use their insincerity to disguise an undeclared agenda. Their agenda is the disarming of the American people, a people already disarmed of the protections of the Constitution by the fake war on terror. The only remaining barrier to tyrannized Americans is the large percentage of the population that is armed and skilled in the use of gun violence. Hacker group could blow lid off 9/11 dark overlord threatens to publish thousands of confidential, damning documents. By John Friend, a notorious international hacking group known as Dark Overlord has threatened to publish thousands of confidential documents purportedly hacked and stolen from a number of insurance, real estate, and law firms that were directly involved with the events and aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, unless a multi-million dollar ransom is met. It was recently reported at the website Vice Motherboard, the mysterious group, which seemingly works as a collective and was targeted and attempted to extort other large corporations and private entities in the past, claimed the secret documents in their possession will provide many answers about 9/11 conspiracies. According to a tweet released by the group on New Year's Eve, the group's Twitter account has since been suspended. The group has claimed to have hacked and stolen important, highly sensitive data relating directly to 9/11 and litigation in its aftermath from a number of top insurance companies and law firms, including Lloyd's of London, Silverstein Properties, and Hiscox Syndicates. Larry Silverstein, the chairman of Silverstein Properties, has long been identified as a key suspect in the events of 9/11. Silverstein Properties acquired the World Trade Center complex in a suspicious privatization scheme involving the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey shortly before the 9/11 attacks, and soon thereafter purchased an insurance policy for the complex that included coverage for acts of terrorism. Silverstein has received billions of dollars as a result of insurance settlements in the years since 9/11, yet acquired the complex for the paltry sum of $14 million, as part of the $3.2 billion lease purchased bid he won. The Dark Overlord Group initially threatened to extort the firms it hacked, demanding payment in Bitcoin from the firms in order to keep their documents private. If you're one of the dozens of solicitor firms who was involved in the litigation, a politician who was involved in the case, a law enforcement agency who was involved in the investigations, a property management firm, an investment bank, a client of a client, a reference of a reference, a global insurer, or whoever else, you're welcome to contact our email below and make a request to formally have your documents and materials withdrawn from any eventual public release of the materials, the group stated shortly after announcing the hack, providing an anonymous email address for potential inquirers. However, you'll be paying us. The group has since announced that the public can make payments to unlock the documents and have them published online, and has apparently received $12,000 worth of Bitcoin, resulting in the release of 650 documents that have been published so far. Roughly 18,000 documents are alleged to have been hacked and stolen by the group, according to a report published by RT, Russia's state-sponsored media platform. These 650 documents comprise layer one of the massive confidential data, according to Dark Overlord. They claim to have four more layers of hacked data that are still in their possession, and that each layer contains more secrets, more damaging materials, and generally just more truth, RT reported. In its latest publicly released statement, addressed to the nation-state of the United States of America and the greater deep state, the group declares, "Your censorship and fake news cover ups won't silence this organization or its public support." The statement then goes on to threaten the various parties involved by claiming, "We're going to burn you down unless you begin to play ball. We're peeling these layers back like an onion. No one can save you except for us." Deep Truth Journal has finally arrived. Deep Truth Journal, DTJ, is the magazine that will make the state-sponsored talking heads, court historians, and textbook conglomerates rethink what they've done throughout their comfortable careers. It's the journal that is set to blow the lid off the historical establishment by challenging it with facts, eyewitness testimony, and biting commentary in an effort to offer an alternative to the status quo. Don't let the cozy academics define truth for you. Go deeper and get history resolved with Deep Truth Journal. In this 132-page inaugural issue of DTJ, we have gathered together some of the most respected historical and political researchers ever assembled in one publication. James DiEugenio's feature on JFK, Dag Hammarskjöld, and Patrice Lumumba examines the crises and deaths of three men out to change the future of Africa. Deep state actors didn't want the Congo to be truly independent, as the theft of its mineral wealth was enriching colonial powers who didn't want to see the contents of this treasure chest going to the people of the Congo. Were they all assassinated to protect deep state profits? DiEugenio reveals the truth. William Davy profiles Jim Garrison, who in 1969 prosecuted the only trial attempting to resolve the murder of President Kennedy. Find out how Garrison's investigation unfolded and who he believed was deeply involved in the assassination of JFK. Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965, but were deep state actors involved? Renowned African-American journalist and author Carl Evans delves into the intelligence community's involvement in the murder of Malcolm X and how his timely death solved a serious problem for the deep state. Researcher Douglas Horn details FDR's plan to lure the Japanese to Pearl Harbor, incorporating new research on this day of infamy and death. Political conspiracy expert Jim Haugen looks deeper into the identity of Watergate's deep throat, while Lisa Pease exposes the CIA's nefarious connections to the mainstream media and why this is such a problem for American democracy today. In Why the State Hates Conspiracy, respected investigator Joseph Green questions why the media covers the stories it does while ignoring important topics much more vital to our futures. Our inaugural edition of DTJ also includes John Podash on the sabotage of the candidacies of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump by the deep state, Donald Jeffers' critical view of Abraham Lincoln and his policed state, St. Patrick's look at the censoring of college professors and the state of free speech at institutions of higher learning today. Also included are columns by Richard Bartholomew and Randolph Benson, as well as features on the mysterious murder of Seth Rich and the myths of American history that still cloud our understanding of the past. Currently, DTJ is scheduled for 2 issues per year, but your enthusiasm for this kind of previously censored information can make the difference. Support DTJ's efforts by buying a copy for yourself and additional copies for friends and family. Purchase copies for libraries and universities. Help us break through the blockade on the truth. Copies of DTJ are $15 each. Please include $4 S&H per copy for addresses inside the U.S. Outside the U.S. you must add $25 S&H for one copy. AFP is handling DTJ's fulfillment, so call them toll-free at 1-888-699-6397. To charge or send an order to AFP, 16,000 Tradezone Avenue, Unit 406, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20,774. Email the editorial staff with comments at deeptruthjournal@gmail.com. New research magazine launched. You can help make the inaugural edition of Deep Truth Journal a rousing success. By St. Patrick, we are proud to announce the first ever issue of Deep Truth Journal, DTJ, a magazine of deep politics and historical research that exists to challenge the historical establishment and textbook conglomerates that control the dissemination of information today. While we are all excited to bring you something new, fresh, and exciting, I am the editor of this issue. This is the culmination of decades of work and research. As a college student, I sat in my dorm room and watched coverage of Ruby Ridge, Waco, and the Oklahoma City bombing on my television. I was in the middle of teaching a high school American history course when a colleague rushed into the classroom and told us to turn the television on because the World Trade Center had been hit twice by passenger liners. Before then, I had always been fascinated by the political assassinations of the 1960s, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, among others. I was fortunate enough to have had a high school history teacher who taught us, as fact, that FDR intentionally led Japan to Pearl Harbor as a pretense by which American popular opinion would support entry into World War II. One of the first alternative books I bought as a high school student was Robert Groden's High Treason. Today, I am glad to call Robert a friend. Before the magazine could be a tangible object, we had to commission writers. We agreed to enlist what I believe is an all-star team of alternative researchers. Jim DiEugenio is one of the most widely read JFK researchers, a friend and Kennedy research advisor to Oliver Stone. DiEugenio operates the website Kennedys and King, which is the leading Kennedy research site online today. DiEugenio wrote the cover story for this inaugural edition of DTJ, How the Congo Descended into Darkness. In this brilliant piece, he links the tragedies of the JFK assassination, the murder of Patrice Lumumba, and the plane crash, possible assassination, of UN Secretary Gen. Dag Hammarskjöld. Jim Haugen is the godfather of Watergate revisionism. His book Secret Agenda changed the way many now view the Watergate story. He was the first researcher to really challenge the idea that John Dean and Deep Throat were the heroes of the story. For DTJ, He contributed his dissection of Mark Felt's deep throat in an article entitled Throat, Felt, Bennett, and the Post-Coital Problem, Must Reading for Any Historical Skeptic. Lisa Pease was one of the co-founders of Probe magazine and just released what will become the definitive book on the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, A Lie Too Big to Fail. In DTJ, she takes a look at why fake news is such a threat to democracy. Pease trains both barrels on the CIA's poisonous influence within the controlled Mockingbird media. Douglas Horn served on the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Review Board, ARRB, and remains an accomplished author and lecturer. His work for DTJ, August 1941, examines exactly how FDR lured the Japanese to Hawaii in an effort to get America into a war with Nazi Germany. Using newly unearthed documents, Horn cements his thesis. Deep Truth Journal will include a researcher profile in each planned issue. The first researcher profiled is Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney who prosecuted the only trial in the case of the JFK assassination. William Davey, the author of Let Justice Be Done, pens the Garrison profile, explaining in riveting fashion why Garrison believed that deep state players, in collusion with other powerful entities, murdered the president. Also included, the astute Joseph Green explains why the state hates conspiracy. Former Washington Post reporter and author Carl Evans looks at the forces behind the killing of Malcolm X. Donald Jeffries assesses Abraham Lincoln's new American police state, and author John Potash dissects how the deep state used Sanders and Trump, and then tried to destroy them both. Researcher Richard Bartholomew exposes journalist Bill Moyers's big secret, and some others. And Duke University professor Randolph Benson looks at why the historical establishment brands some sources trustworthy and others as purveyors of fake conspiracy theories. Deep Truth Journal is a beautifully designed, professionally assembled magazine that really serves as a cannon blast across the bow of the elite historical establishment that believes it has the authority and position to dictate what truthful history is or isn't. Every purchase of DTJ is an educational protest to that establishment. You will want to be on board for the inaugural issue of Deep Truth Journal, which the publisher, FBF Books, has made available to American Free Press for individual sale at just $15. This issue will become a collector's edition in the coming years. You can get one now by ordering from the AFP website store or by sending $15 plus $4 S&H in U.S. to AFP, 16,000 Trade Zone Avenue, Unit 406, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20,774. While DTJ is currently planning to release two issues per year, this issue is 132 power-packed pages. Reader interest will dictate how we proceed in the future and how many issues we can produce each year. At this point in time, it is not a subscription-based product. Each issue will emerge when it is ready and be offered for sale. Obviously, without your support, a new conspiracy magazine like this one has no chance to succeed, so we are counting on AFP readers to light up the phone lines and inundate our order processors. See the facing page for a little more about this exciting new publication and for an order form if you prefer to respond by mail. Thankfully, AFP has agreed to carry our first issue, and hopefully succeeding issues, in its bookstore. So make your checks and money orders payable to American Free Press or just AFP. H. Big tech companies continue to target political dissidents. By John Friend. Conservative commentators and other political dissidents continue to feel the effects of an increasingly brazen censorship and deplatforming campaign led by some of the top technology companies in Silicon Valley as 2018 came to a close. In December, Patreon, a leading crowdfunding site that allows content creators to set up a profile and raise money from supporters in the form of one-time or recurring donations, banned the profiles of two prominent conservative political pundits, Milo Yiannopoulos, a former editor of Breitbart News, and Carl Benjamin, a British YouTuber commonly known as his online alias Sargon of Akkad. I've had a miserable year too, banned and deplatformed and censored and blacklisted, Yiannopoulos lamented on his Patreon page before his account was quickly suspended by the company. Now I need your help. I want to get back on my feet and come roaring back in 2019. Needless to say, Yaina Palace will have to find another platform to get back on his feet if he's to come roaring back, as Patreon banned the controversial pundit shortly after he created the account. Patreon stated in a tweet that Milo Yaina Palace was removed from Patreon as we don't allow association with or supporting hate groups on Patreon. Yaina Palace has long been associated with the Proud Boys, a pro-Western fraternal organization founded by Gavin McGinnis that has come under extreme scrutiny in recent months. The Proud Boys have been hysterically denounced by many mainstream media outlets, political commentators, and anti-American activist organizations such as the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group that is responsible for political violence, false claims endlessly repeated by the fake news media. Benjamin was also banned from the crowdfunding platform last month. Benjamin had been using Patreon to allow his viewers and supporters to fund his independent journalistic endeavors, which netted the British commentator $12,000 per month, according to the site. Patreon told Vice News that Benjamin was banned from its site for his violation of hate speech in our guidelines. The tech giant has accused the YouTube star of using racial and homophobic slurs to degrade another individual. The irony of banning Benjamin, though, is that he doesn't even call himself a conservative. He characterizes himself as a classical English liberal and is considered to be only slightly left of center on the political spectrum. In related news, a number of leftist activist groups have organized a campaign to demand that advertisers stop placing ads with Tucker Carlson's popular Fox News program. Carlson has been a major critic of the radical left and their attempts to destroy America with massive third world immigration, amnesty for illegal aliens, open borders, and forced multiculturalism. These very vocal far-left groups want advertisers to boycott Carlson's show in an effort to shut down and deplatform the increasingly popular host. Thus far, the calls for a boycott have been largely unsuccessful, and Fox News has commendably stood by and supported Carlson. "We cannot and will not allow voices like Tucker Carlson to be censored by agenda-driven intimidation efforts from the likes of Movian.org, Media Matters, and Sleeping Giants," Fox News said in a statement to the Daily Wire. "Attempts were made last month to bully and terrorize Tucker and his family at their home. He is now once again being threatened via Twitter by far-left activist groups with deeply political motives." The statement went on to read, "While we do not advocate boycotts, these same groups never target other broadcasters and operate under a grossly hypocritical double standard given their intolerance to all opposing points of view. We can expect the First Amendment free speech rights of dissident commentators, pundits, and independent media outlets to continue to be challenged by the radical left and large corporate tech companies, like those dominating Silicon Valley, as we enter 2019. Just say no to government abuses. Everything the Founding Fathers feared has come to dominate in modern America," by John W. Whitehead. "Let's make 2019 the year we refuse to allow the government's abusive behavior to be our new normal. Here's just a small sampling of what we suffered through in 2018. The government didn't listen to the citizenry, refused to abide by the Constitution, and treated the citizenry as a source of funding and little else. Police officers shot unarmed citizens and their household pets. Government agents, including local police, were armed to the teeth and encouraged to act like soldiers on a battlefield. Bloated government agencies were allowed to fleece taxpayers. Government technicians spied on our emails and phone calls, and government contractors made a killing by waging endless wars abroad, not content to expand the police state's power to search, strip, seize, raid, steal from, arrest, and jail Americans for any infraction, no matter how insignificant. The Trump administration gave state courts the green light to resume their practice of jailing individuals who are unable to pay the hefty fines imposed by the American police state. These debtors' prisons play right into the hands of those who make a profit by jailing Americans. We are not supposed to be living in a show-me-your-papers society." Despite this, the U.S. government has introduced measures allowing police and other law enforcement officials to stop individuals, citizens and non-citizens alike, demand they identify themselves, and subject them to pat-downs, warrantless searches, and interrogations. The government waged war on military veterans, Military veterans have increasingly been treated like criminals, targeted for surveillance, censorship, threatened with incarceration or involuntary commitment, labeled as extremists and are mentally ill, and stripped of their Second Amendment rights, for daring to speak out against government misconduct. Free speech was dealt one knockout punch after another. On paper, we are technically free to speak. In reality, however, we are only as free to speak as a government official, or corporate entities such as Facebook, Google or YouTube, may allow. The reasons for such censorship varied widely from political correctness, safety concerns, and bullying to national security and hate crimes, but the end result remained the same, the complete eradication of free speech. Police became even more militarized and weaponized. Despite concerns about the government's steady transformation of local police into a standing military army, local police agencies continue to acquire weaponry, training, and equipment suited for the battlefield, with full support from the Trump administration. There are now reportedly more bureaucratic, non-military, government civilians armed with high-tech, deadly weapons than U.S. Marines. Police waged a war on kids, so-called school safety policies, which run the gamut from zero-tolerance policies that punish all infractions harshly to surveillance cameras, metal detectors, random searches, drug-sniffing dogs, school-wide lockdowns, active shooter drills, and militarized police officers, turned schools into prisons and young people into prisoners. According to the Washington Post, more than 4 million children endured lockdowns last school year, leaving many traumatized. The American system of representative government was overthrown by the deep state, also known as the police state, also known as the military-industrial complex, a profit-driven, militaristic corporate state bent on total control and global domination through the imposition of martial law here at home and by fomenting wars abroad. When in doubt, follow the money trail. It always points the way. The takeaway: everything the founders of this country feared has come to dominate in modern America. As long as we continue to allow callousness, cruelty, meanness, immorality, ignorance, hatred, intolerance, racism, militarism, materialism, vindictiveness, and injustice, magnified by an echo chamber of nasty tweets and government-sanctioned brutality, to trump justice, fairness, and equality, there can be no hope of prevailing against the policed state. U.S., Taliban begin peace negotiations after Syria. President Trump looks to exact even more peace in the Middle East. By St. Patrick, much of the clamor that has existed in the media of late has been the debate over the Trump decision to move toward ending U.S. involvement in Syria. All but ignored by the same media and politicians have been the recent overtures for peace in Afghanistan that have existed between the U.S. and the Taliban. In December, American representatives met with Taliban officials in the United Arab Emirates. They will meet again in the Persian Gulf to complete the Afghanistan reconciliation process. This is a historic step forward in the process to resolve America's longest ongoing war. Yet the media has become blinded by the Russian angles of Syrian intervention. The United States invaded Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, almost 1 month after the attacks of 9/11. The publicly stated mission was to destroy Al-Qaeda's stronghold in Afghanistan by dethroning the Taliban throughout the region. Now, at over 17 years, the war in Afghanistan is America's second longest war. The Vietnam War lasted 19 years. Reports have stated that the recent peace talks were initiated by the Trump administration. Pakistan has taken credit for urging the Taliban officials to re-engage in response. Negotiations over talks have existed from other administrations in the 17 years, but they fizzled quickly. The December talks produced positive results. The Emirates news agency said that the recent Abu Dhabi talks fructified in tangible results that are positive for all parties concerned. The U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, was predictably optimistic about the talks. The Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, agreed with the assessment. Future negotiation meetings shall continue after deliberations and consultations by both sides with their respective leaderships, Mujahid said. For the Taliban, The focal point of the negotiations is the withdrawal of all NATO and U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Mujahid denied that rumored items such as future elections, peace talks with Kabul, agreeing on an interim Afghan government, and a temporary ceasefire were discussed. Of course, diplomacy is often a struggle in minutiae and ego. Islamabad now accuses the U.S. of downplaying Pakistan's importance in bringing the Taliban representatives to the table. Pakistan may also be angered by the Trump decision to suspend hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Pakistan because it has not acted decisively against the Taliban in recent years. Pakistan is also concerned that a newly departed Afghan, ISTAN, would leave a gaping vacuum that U.S. ally India would move to fill. The doves that circle this peace process are concerned that they may end up as canaries in coal mines. And though the U.S. delegation approved further peace talks to occur in Saudi Arabia, the Taliban has stated that it will not approve the location. The Saudis had pushed to include the UN-backed Afghan government in the talks. Taliban representatives have pushed back and now openly state that they will go to Qatar for the talks. A senior Taliban member was quoted, explaining the move. "Everyone is aware of the fact that the Afghan government wanted the U.S. and its allies not to leave Afghanistan, and we have paid a heavy price to expel all foreign forces from our country," he said. Though it was denied as a topic on the table in the talks, rumors still strongly persist that what is being discussed is a 2019 ceasefire in Afghanistan. If the Trump administration can end American involvement in both Syria and Afghanistan, it will be a foreign policy record that will be challenging to deny historically. That said, Democrats, neoconservatives, and major media outlets who profit mightily from war and conflict will find a way to darken the most silver linings. It was Fidel Castro who made the famous "History will absolve me" speech. He understood that history as a tool can heal immediate rifts. There will be no moment of clarity with the mainstream mass media, the Democratic Party, or the never-Trump Republicans. This is a political war that exists until the Donald and Melania helicopter out of the Beltway. But 20 years later, when columns of achievements are listed, many are going to be surprised that the Trump administration fared very well on the issue of peace. Then they will have to reconcile how the man they have painted as the most hated personality in the world was simultaneously the one who negotiated for peace. This isn't JFK's Democratic Party new generation of crude-mouthed, race-baiting leftist politicians emerge on scene. By Patrick J. Buchanan, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's House has more women, persons of color, and LGBT members than any House in history, and fewer white males. And recently, the day Rashida Tlaib was sworn in, her hand on a Quran, our first Palestinian-American congresswoman showed us what we may expect. As a rally of leftists lustily cheered her on, Tlaib roared, "We're gonna impeach them Arthur." Not only was no apology forthcoming, the host of the New American Leaders event where Tlaib spoke warmly endorsed her gutter language. Her remarks, said Sabatwini, were raw and honest, and came straight from the heart, a refreshing break from the canned comments our elected leaders usually make. Tlaib spoke with the fire that so many at our event wanted to hear. Sunday, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, 29, the youngest member of the new House, told CNN there is no question President Donald Trump is a racist, for he regularly uses historic dog whistles of white supremacy, while the Democratic Party is celebrating a diversity that insists that the more women, persons of color, and gays in leadership ranks, and the fewer white males, the stronger and better the party. Has all of America embraced this as an ideal? Is there no limit to the ideological, political, religious, racial and ethnic diversity a party and nation can tolerate before it comes apart? Are Democrats inviting an eventual balkanization of their party and country? Consider, this week, Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio and HUD secretary, appeared about to enter the race for the Democratic nomination. Castro has seen fellow Texan Robert F. O'Rourke, who goes by the nickname Beto, walk off with his Hispanic constituency in a 2018 Senate race. Castro intends to win it back in the Democratic primaries. Former Rep. O'Rourke has been accused of trying to pass himself off as Hispanic, though he is of Irish descent. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Mass., suffered a near fatal wound trying to pass herself off as part Cherokee Indian. In December, Mays Jackson, morning host of a radio station that reaches into Chicago's black community, said of the mayoral election to succeed Rahm Emanuel, where 21 candidates have filed and a black woman and a Hispanic woman are the front runners, "This thing is going to get so tribal." The Democrat front runners for the presidential nomination, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders and Beto, are white males, ranked just below are black senators Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. South Carolina is a state where a large slice of the Democratic vote is African American. Jesse Jackson won the caucuses in 1988, and Harris and Booker should expect to do well if they do not split that vote. While racial and ethnic voting is not new, it appears much more intense. In the last Congress, the 33 U.S. congressional districts with the largest concentrations of black voters almost all elected African Americans who became members of the racially exclusive Black Caucus. The first two battles of 2020, Iowa and New Hampshire, are in states predominantly white. Warren has made several stops in Iowa with impressive turnouts, putting pressure on Biden and Sanders to decide soon. But while Biden is the frontrunner, consider how far away the ex-vice president is from the new realities in his party. Though millennials are one voting bloc Democrats are courting most, Biden would be the oldest president ever elected. He was in the Senate for a decade before Ocasio-Cortez and Tlaib were even born. Biden is an old white male in a party that wants the torch passed to women and minorities. He backed George W. Bush and Dick Cheney in voting for the war in Iraq. He backed an anti-crime bill in the early 1990s that incarcerated individuals now gaining release by the latest crime bill. As Judiciary Committee Chair, he presided over the hearings that resulted in a vote to elevate Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. The Republican Party, even with the never-Trumpers gone, still seems more united than a Democratic Party where the differences are not only ideological but also racial, religious, and tribal. Ocasio-Cortez is backing a hike in the top federal income tax rate to 70%. Castro has suggested taking a look at a top rate of 90%. How will this sit with the big Democratic donors? Biden, like Pelosi, was raised Catholic in a church that taught that homosexuality was immoral and abortion was the killing of the innocent unborn, for which the sanction was automatic excommunication. Today, the Democratic Party celebrates same-sex marriage as social progress and regards abortion as a cherished constitutional right. A floor battle erupted at its 2012 Charlotte, NC, convention over whether God should even be mentioned in the party platform. Yet Pelosi denounced recently the idea of building a security wall along America's border with Mexico as immoral. No, this is not JFK's party anymore. That party is long dead. Will immigration bloodshed continue? American citizens continue to be the tragic victims of sanctuary policies. By John Friend, two recent tragic cases highlight the danger illegal aliens pose to U.S. citizens, particularly in so-called sanctuary states like California that largely forbid state and local law enforcement agencies from coordinating and cooperating with federal immigration authorities. In late December, Gustavo Garcia, a 36-year-old illegal alien with a lengthy criminal record who had previously been deported from the U.S. on two separate occasions, went on a violent criminal rampage into Larry County in central California before being killed in a high-speed chase with California law enforcement officers. Garcia's rampage began on the afternoon of Sunday, December 16, when he shot and wounded a local farm worker and then proceeded to rob a local convenience store at gunpoint, stealing roughly $2,000 in cash. Later that day, Garcia shot a female guest at a Motel 6 in the chest and arm. Neither the farm worker nor the female shot by Garcia suffered life-threatening injuries. In the early morning hours of Monday, December 17, Garcia's violent crime spree continued, as he shot up a gas station in the area, killing one man who police identified as Rocky Paul Jones, 51. Garcia then fired shots in the backyard of his girlfriend's house where he had been living, before leaving and being pursued by sheriff's deputies. During the chase, Garcia fired shots at officers before wrecking his car. He then proceeded to steal another vehicle and led officers on yet another high-speed chase at speeds approaching 100 miles per hour. During the chase, multiple vehicles were struck, resulting in serious injuries to several of the unfortunate victims of Garcia's rampage. Following the final accident Garcia caused during the chase, the violent criminal, who had been living illegally in the United States for an unknown period of time, was thrown from the stolen vehicle and died. Garcia is believed to have committed at least 11 different crimes during the rampage, including an officer-involved shooting, homicide, and robbery. Incredibly, he had been in police custody just 2 days prior to his criminal rampage for being under the influence of a controlled substance and had a long criminal record, including multiple assaults with a deadly weapon, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, vandalism, and possession of a controlled substance, according to news reports. The Visalia Times Delta, a news outlet in the area, reported that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, officials had alerted local law enforcement officials that Garcia was a known violent criminal who had been deported in 2004 and again in 2014. He had already served 27 months in federal prison for illegally re-entering the country yet managed to evade immigration authorities. ICE agents had apparently issued an immigration hold for Garcia when he was in police custody just prior to the deadly rampage, yet the hold was not honored out of California's sanctuary state laws, and Garcia was released. This is an unfortunate and extremely tragic example of how public safety is impacted with laws or policies limiting local law enforcement agencies' ability to cooperate with ICE, the agency said in a statement published by the Times Delta. The Tulare County Sheriff's Office is equally as frustrated with this situation, Tulare County Sheriff Mike Boudreau said following the tragic incident. Because of California law, detainers can no longer be recognized by local law enforcement. In a separate and equally tragic incident that also took place in California, six individuals with dubious immigration status have been arrested in connection with the murder of a California police officer who had legally immigrated to the United States. Police Corporal Ronald Singh of the Newman Police Department, who was described as an American patriot by Newman Police Chief Randy Richardson, was murdered the day after Christmas when he was shot by Gustavo Perez Arriaga, a 32-year-old illegal alien who had two previous DUI convictions. Singh had pulled over Arriaga for suspicion of drunk driving in the early morning hours of Wednesday, December 26. Arriaga shot the officer before fleeing the scene, resulting in Singh's tragic death. 2 days later, police arrested Arriaga and two accomplices, all believed to be living in the U.S. illegally, Adrian Virgin, 25, Arriaga's brother, and Eric Razo Quiros, 32, a co-worker of Arriaga's. According to Stanislaus County Sheriff Adam Christensen, Arriaga was a known gang member who worked on the local dairy farms. Christensen also said that Virgin and Quiros were arrested because they intentionally lied to us and misled us, according to local reports. Both men now face a charge of being accessories after the fact to a felony. Three other individuals were also later arrested in neighboring Kern County for their role in helping Arriaga evade law enforcement authorities and attempt to flee the country to Mexico following the murder. Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood announced charges against Bernabe Madrigal Castaneda, 59, Erasmo Villegas, 36, and Maria Luisa Marino, 57, all of Bakersfield, who were arrested on charges of aiding and abetting Arriaga. In the aftermath of the officer's murder, Christensen expressed frustration with California's sanctuary laws, which hinder local and state law enforcement agencies from cooperating with federal immigration officials. We should have been allowed to report him to ICE, Christensen said in a press conference after the arrests, referring to Arriaga, but because of sanctuary laws we could not. Had Arriaga not been in the country, the outcome could have been different, Christensen lamented. Why are we providing sanctuary for criminals, for gang members? At the news conference, Christensen emphasized that his deputies are not interested in enforcing immigration law. That's not our job, Christensen stated, but law enforcement should be able to turn people over to ICE who are gang members who victimize and exploit others. These tragic incidents will no doubt inflame the already intense debate over immigration in this country. Iran's revolution turns 40. Americans should realize we are fighting the same enemies. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. America's mainstream propaganda media keep telling us to hate Iran. Trump's key advisors, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton, and neocon-influenced outlets like Fox and Breitbart, hate Iran even more than the liberal media does. So I expect to make few friends, and quite a few enemies on all sides of the spectrum, by saying that in many respects Iran's Islamic Revolution, which turns 40 years old this February, would be a good model for American renewal. Disclaimer: I will be traveling to Tehran in February for a New Horizons NGO conference celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In the past, I have traveled to New Horizons conferences in Iran alongside people like former Senator Mike Gravel, D'Alaska, ex-U.S. Army PsyOps Officer Scott Bennett, former Defense Department Senior Security Policy Analyst F. Michael Maloof, and Culture Wars Magazine Editor E. Michael Jones. What's more, I was responsible for getting all four of those patriotic, highly accomplished Americans invited to Iran. I have been friends with some of the New Horizons organizers since 2012 and agree with them that Americans are sadly misinformed about the Islamic Republic and its relations with the U.S. It is one thing to say that the United States should mend fences with Iran. Many mainstream experts agree on that, but it is quite another to say the U.S. should consider emulating the Islamic Republic. Isn't Iran a theocracy? Doesn't the supreme leader have quasi-dictatorial powers? How could the U.S. possibly follow such a model? I am certainly not calling for an American Islamic Republic presided over by Shia religious scholars. Though come to think of it, that wouldn't be any worse than what we have now. Instead, I want to suggest that we should consider being faithful to our own unique identity in the same way Iran is faithful to its identity. And just as Iran's identity is a fully independent, democratic republican, anti-imperialist, anti-international Bonkar Islamic nation with a Persian-dominant ethnic history grows out of its 1979 revolution, America's ostensible identity as a fully independent, democratic republican, anti-imperialist, anti-international banker Enlightenment Christian nation with a European-dominant ethnic history grows out of our revolution of 1776. The big difference is that Iran is holding steadfast to its revolutionary Islamic Republican principles, while the U.S. has treasonously betrayed its own identity. We should emulate Iran not by adopting theocracy but by returning to the principles of our revolution and sticking by them even when powerful foreign interests pressure us to abandon them. The Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979, like the American Revolution of 1776, was in essence a revolt against the world's biggest empire of the time and against the international bankers who owned that empire. In both cases, the bankster empire was trying to impose its ideology on its occupied colony. The British Empire of 1776 represented royalty and authoritarianism, while the American revolutionaries embraced anti-authoritarian, democratic, republican Enlightenment thought. Likewise, the U.S. Zionist Empire of 1979 represented secular humanist, globalist, capitalist materialism, while Iran's Islamic revolutionaries wanted national independence and a return to their own Islamic tradition. Interestingly, the Iranian Revolution did not reject democratic republicanism, but instead enshrined it in its constitution. Today, Iran is the Middle East's only genuine democracy, with a supreme leader who is himself popularly if indirectly elected, and who enjoys powers comparable to the American president and chief justice. Both the American and Iranian revolutions quickly came under attack by the forces of empire. The British, unhappy with the loss of their American colonies and bent on revenge, burned Washington, D.C. to the ground in the War of 1812, fomented the Southern Secession of 1860, seized control of America's currency in 1913, and dragged the U.S. into two world wars it had no business fighting. The 1979 American Empire, guided by New York bankers and their City of London and House of Rothschild friends, likewise tried to overthrow Iran's Islamic Revolution. George H.W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld armed Saddam Hussein to the teeth with chemical weapons, which during the 1980s U.S. imposed war were unleashed in vast quantity against the people of Iran, a much bigger catastrophe than Americans suffered when Washington, D.C. was burned by the British in 1812, after the empire's then puppet Saddam Hussein failed to overthrow the Islamic Republic. The Zionist imperialists continued to plot against Iran, culminating in the 9/11 false flag operation. As former National Security Council member Gwen It's Todd recently stated on my Truth Jihad radio show, the purpose of the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan was to surround Iran with U.S. bases, and then invade and overthrow the Islamic Republic on behalf of Israel. Bottom line, both the U.S. and Iran face the same enemy, the Zionists. We Americans should resist and expel them, as Iran has, and regain our independence.